This is Conducting Business, a podcast about the music industry from WQXR.org. I'm Naomi Lewin. If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. But as a classical musician in New York, just making it here appears to be an increasingly tough notion. Recent reports suggest that the New York freelance musician is a dying breed. Broadway jobs are in decline, dance companies increasingly rely on recorded music, and many freelance orchestras are cutting back on their seasons, sometimes to nothingness. So what is to blame for this? Is there any bright spot? Maybe through technology. Joining me to discuss this are three guests. On the line is Miriam Sukar, a reporter at Crane's New York Business who covers the arts. In the studio, we have Gene Cook, a director of programs at the Future of Music Coalition, which has undertaken a study on the economics of the music industry. And also in the studio, Mary Rowell, a violinist who co-founded the string quartet Ethel. She's also a host on Q2 Music, WQXR's new music channel. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Miriam, last week you wrote a story with the headline, Musicians' Woes Reach New Lows as Work Fades. Now, we've been hearing for several years that classical music organizations, especially orchestras, have been struggling. What in particular is happening now that triggered this story?
Well, it just seems that musicians are being hit from all sides. They started their struggle on Broadway back in 2003 when the producers were trying to abolish the minimum requirements for musicians in the pit. Then, since then, we just recently had the Paul Taylor Dance Company perform their spring season at Lincoln Center with no live music at all. Then they're hit from the woes of the New York City Opera, which obviously has their own financial problems, but their work is being cut there. So it's just coming at them from all sides.
Gene, you have been doing research on this. What has the research you've done uncovered about the ways classical musicians are making a living?
Well, over the last 2.5 years, Future of Music Coalition has been conducting a study, the Artist Revenue Stream study that you referred to, and we were gathering information in a lot of different ways. One of them is interviewing people. We did qualitative interviews with 80 different kinds of musicians, and then we also did a large online survey in the fall. About 5,000 people were taking the survey, and of those 5,000 people, I think about 37% of them said that they worked in classical music. We also have done a series of financial case studies where we look at an individual artist and see how their income has shifted over the last few years. What we've been seeing about classical music, we partnered with the American Federation of Musicians, and a lot of people who took the survey were AFFM members, so we were able to actually look at the difference between AFFM members and non-AFFM members.
That's the Musicians Union.
The Musicians Union, absolutely. And one of the things that we noticed was that, you know, when you ask them about their income, you know, it varies a little bit across genre, but for the most part, AFFM members were making, you know, maybe $10,000 more than non-AFFM members on average. And, you know, some of that may not necessarily be because they're AFFM members so much as it is that they're a little bit older and they're a little further down in their careers. But the interesting thing when you look at those two groups of people and you ask them about how things have been over the last 5 years, income is kind of down across the board for a lot of folks who are relying on session work, who are part of orchestras, who are freelancers, and who are doing recording, whereas people outside of the union were reporting that things were kind of looking up in certain areas.
What is the non-union work?
Well, the non-union work would be any kind of performance that you're doing that isn't done under a union contract. And there are plenty of those in New York that classical people do, things like weddings, for example. Or if you were to play in a, you know, some of the new music ensembles, or maybe if you're a session musician and you're going to be doing some background stuff in a studio or something like that, which is going to be more on the independent side. So those wouldn't necessarily be under union contracts. People who are younger, or kind of starting out in their careers tend to be a little bit more optimistic about how things are going. Because when you're starting from nowhere, not to say that people are always starting from nowhere, but when you're starting in your career and you have everything to look forward to, then, you know, I think that it's easier to see kind of year-to-year gains. Whereas if you've been doing what you've been doing for maybe 15, 20, maybe 30 or 40 years, then you start to see more of the ups and downs. And I think generally the trend has been going downward as far as it's perceived by people who took our survey.
Well, yeah. If I can ask, we have a working musician here. Mary, you have been working as a violinist in New York for how many years?
Well, at least 30.
And Have you seen work dry up compared to when you started?
I would say yes.
I've noticed
mostly, well, it used to be when I was a kid, I knew all these people, and we never saw each other at all during, you know, except if we happened to run into each other. We were all working in New York and making enough money to live on. So I think that there's less work going on. And, you know, people are all looking at Broadway. That's really kind of the last gasp of legitimate work in New York. Legitimate meaning union work that pays some benefits and gets you unemployment and things like that.
And
health
are,
insurance.
You are currently.
Well, I just took on a Broadway show. It came up. It wasn't really looking for it, and it came my way, and I decided, oh, it's a limited run. I'll do it. It looks like it's going to be a hit. That's good in the scheme of things. But I've also, the last 13 years, was running a string quartet and spending most of my time doing that and not really doing the freelance work so much. And I was, after I left the quartet last year, I was thinking, wow, what am I going to do now? Because for income, I mean, I know I need to do something else artistically. And
so a string quartet was a good steady income?
It was not enough to live on, no. And I also had a couple other steady jobs. I work at Radio City Music Hall for the Christmas show, and I've had that job.
And that's a union job.
It's a union job, and it's seasonal work in November and December every year. I also had a job in Florida as concertmaster of an orchestra there, once a month go down.
How do you deal with signing on for the fundamental insecurity of a career that is built on freelancing?
Well, it takes a certain type of person to be able to do it. I mean, in the day when there was lots of work going on, I mean, one day you'd be, you know, orchestra rehearsal, doing chamber music, premiering a new contemporary music piece, going to the studio and doing a jingle or two, and then in the evening doing a performance of one of the things that you'd rehearsed that day or something else, you know, or playing in the rock band. So tremendous variety, and a lot of people chose that. Even back when David Nadian was the concertmaster of the New York Philharmonic, and he left the New York Philharmonic to do the studio work that was in New York. He was making much more money, and the variety was just wonderful. You know, you're never bored. And today, those options are not there. You know, the recording work really has dried up in New York, except for, well, I guess you would call them scab sessions, if you were
non-union
work. And there is some of that left, but the synthesizers have really gotten wonderful.
One of the things that I was just thinking about as you were talking was, you know, making a distinction. There's recording work and there's live work. And as Naomi was saying, that to be able to make a living as a classical musician, a lot of it is live work. And so you really have to kind of line it up and you have to keep it going. And when you can no longer perform, then that income is no longer available to you.
That's right.
And one of the things that we spend a lot of time with on this study is just looking at all the different kinds of income streams that musicians have. Classical musicians tend to have simpler income streams. They're really kind of live performance heavy. But there are a couple of other income streams that I think are kind of interesting, like if you do a jingle or if you do some film music, for example. When the film gets rebroadcast, you know, there's a payment that's made to the musician. So there are some places where it's a term that's called mailbox money in some places of in some parts of music, where it's like there's a kind of work that you do where you invest it, like if you're a composer or something, and then your song gets recorded and then you get paid mechanical royalties. And then if that recording ends up getting licensed and broadcast, you know, for a commercial or for television, every time it gets broadcast, there's a little bit of money that comes to you. And, you know, and also ASCAP will collect money for you when it's broadcast on radio. And the mailbox money ends up becoming very important for musicians as they get older, because that's one thing that'll be kind of, you know, it's something that you don't necessarily have to work towards. And on a day-to-day basis, it's just money that comes towards you from work that you've already done.
But yes, but the issue with that is they've gotten wind of that. They're smart now. They don't broadcast the commercial 13 weeks anymore and give you the repayment. They stop short. So, I mean, I used to get residual checks, not that many, but I don't get them at all anymore.
So there is a cutoff that if they go beyond a certain point,
they
have to pay your residuals?
Yeah, it's every 13 weeks you have to repay.
So they deliberately cut off.
Yeah, so they just, it's much cheaper for them to make a new commercial. And there is a definite anti-union interest from the top.
When you say from the top, do you mean from the production companies or from?
I think from pretty much everywhere, Lincoln Center down.
I want to bring Miriam back in here. She's sitting there patiently on the phone.
Oh.
And one of the things you brought up in your story was that the Musicians Union took legal action against the Broadway show, Priscilla, the Queen of the Desert. Why don't you explain what was going on there?
Well, the minimum requirement for musicians in the Palace Theater where Priscilla is playing is 18, and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert is using only 9 musicians and then their own recorded type of synthetic score. So the Musicians Union has, you know, aggressively gone after that, and now they're in arbitration and they're waiting for a date. I believe it's coming up next month or this month, but they don't have that date yet. But in the meantime, Priscilla has been allowed to play for the last year and a half.
How did they get away with
it? The Musicians Union feel that this is just happening more and more. And they are taking on every one of these situations now pretty aggressively.
How could they get away with getting around the minimum requirement?
Well, they said that the show only needs 9 musicians and that it needs this recorded music track because it goes with the what they call synthetic pop flavor of the show. And they said that all of their other productions around the world use only 9 musicians. So they were able to get some sort of rider to continue on like this. But
is this indicative of a trend in Broadway shows?
Well, it seems to be a trend everywhere that it's harder and harder to get audiences. So they're all, you know, trying to get either stars or big sets or glitzy venues. And that all costs money, and they seem to think that the musicians are the most dispensable. So, for example, the Paul Taylor Dance Company, they chose to do this season at Lincoln Center because they thought by doing it at such a prestigious venue would raise a lot of excitement and awareness for their, you know, medium-sized dance troupe. And so they put all of their money into that, and then they said that they don't have the money for the musicians.
Well, but Paul Taylor has not been using live musicians for quite a few years now. They haven't been dancing to live musicians. So I wondered when this protest took place, why the protest now?
I think that the protest now is because they're at Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
And the musicians feel that Lincoln Center, which is such a prestigious, you know, performing arts center, should have live musicians.
Well, do you think dance or Broadway audiences are ready to pay more for having live musicians to accompany?
Well, yeah, that's the question nobody knows. And, of course, everyone's numbers are different. The union said it would have just added maybe $2 to $3 a ticket for Paul Taylor to have live musicians, whereas the Paul Taylor executives said it would have cost them an extra $500,000, and they couldn't find that money. So it's nobody knows. I mean, meanwhile, the ticket prices on Broadway are like a regular ticket now is $150. So I don't know how much more people will be willing to pay.
You know, nobody who becomes a musician goes into it because they were wondering, you know, thinking that they're going to become millionaires. You know, they go into it for the passion of their art. And then there's the, oh, gee, how am I going to make a living? But musicians tend to be creative people, and they're being asked more and more to be creative to make a living. I think a lot of people today are taking on students to help pay the bills. And
is that a viable option still, teaching?
I think so, yeah. I think there, you know, I
is
am
that
not,
what your study has found, that people are?
Yeah, actually earlier when I was talking about how things are going down, when you look at the union perspective, teaching is actually one area, because we did ask specifically about teaching income, that's gone up across the board, not just in classical music, but the majority of people that we surveyed who are teaching were indicating that their teaching income goes up. The nice thing about teaching income is that it's relatively stable and you can count on it. But most of the people that we're talking to that for our study are playing a lot of different roles, kind of as you were talking about earlier, that they have to be a freelancer, that they have to be a teacher, and then in some cases, you know, they'll have the regular gigs that they do as well.
That's true.
And both of you mentioned recordings, jingles, all that kind of thing. How is that business doing these days?
I think everybody's hurting. in the jingle business. The jingle houses I know of have kind of cut back.
And by jingles, we mean backup music.
Commercials. Yeah, mainly commercials. And there are a few people on staff, and they're all using synthesizers and the occasional one player to make it sound.
So it's not like it's moved somewhere else. It's
there's still people working here for sure. But you know, you can do it out of your house now. You know, you don't need a studio. I mean, the other day I had to find a studio in New York, and I was like, wow, there aren't any anymore. You know, a small place that is affordable.
Miriam, do you have something you'd like to throw in here?
Well, I think one thing that the musicians I interviewed with, one thing they said they're grappling with is just the changing, you know, tastes of pop culture.
That is a question I had. Is live music losing its place in our culture?
Well,
no.
No.
It's just changing.
Resounding no's from here.
No,
how about from
no.
the reporter?
Well, certainly not. I think perhaps, though, maybe the kind of, you know, maybe less classical music is popular right now. And I interviewed a very successful harpist, Sarah Cutler, and she said when she came to New York in the 70s, she worked constantly on Broadway. But now there's so many rock and roll shows on Broadway that there's only three productions that call for harps. You know, and then again with the Priscilla situation, they wanted that synthetic recorded music sound. So those are examples perhaps of changing tastes.
Mary, what advice would you give to somebody who's at a conservatory right now, about to graduate, go out into the real world? Would you tell them to go back to school?
Absolutely not. No, I mean, we need, when things go down, where do you go? You go up again. And you can't go up unless you have creative people finding that path. You know, you need the people with the machete out there, you know,
cutting
the path. And in some of us are still able to wield a machete, and but we need that creativity and that exuberance of the young artist.
Jean, we hear about pop musicians who use the internet to promote themselves, sell recordings. How about classical musicians?
Well, I think you're definitely seeing that. I mean, like, it was just a few, it wasn't that long ago that, like, not just Alanis Sonnenberg, for example, started her own label and started distributing it on CD Baby. I think that you're seeing more and more classical folks. Lara St. John is another example. She's got her own record label. She's had it for quite a while, where they're trying to take the developing relationships with audiences into their own hands. They're no longer relying on presenters or record labels to do that for them. And I think that it is benefiting some people. It all kind of points back to a point that Mary was making earlier, where just musicians, if they're going to survive, they really need to be entrepreneurial, and they really need to be able to figure out how to solve their own problems. And if you were to ask, you know, the people at conservatories, like, what is it that they really need? I've been speaking actually with the network of music conservatory development career officers, and those folks are really working with people who are classically trained and about to go into the field, and what is it that they need? And I think overall...
So this is part of their training now?
Well, it's something that they've identified as a gap that they need to fill. And entrepreneurship is certainly something, an area that's growing with conservatories, and I think that it should continue to grow if they want their students to be successful.
Yes, indeed. I've been going back to Juilliard. Robert Sherman has a program there, and he invites in musicians to talk to the kids about, you know, their lives in all fields of music and art. And I've gone back a few times to talk to the kids, and it's been about 3 or 4 years, and I'm seeing some of these kids now out in the workforce, and they come up and identify themselves and saying, you know, you really helped me a lot. And one of the things that I say is, look around you. These are your colleagues, and these are the people that are going to help you the most as you go out into the world. And also, never be a snob about anything you do, and make friends, because if you're a snob and people don't like you, that you're not going to get called again. You know, there's no cheese down that tube.
So. Well, I think cheese down the tube, that's a good place to leave it.
Yeah.
Thank you all very much for joining us. This has been Conducting Business, WQXR.org's podcast on the classical music industry. Our guests have been Miriam Sukar of Crane's New York Business, Jean Cook, Director of Programs at the Future of Music Coalition, and violinist Mary Rowell, who is also a host on Q2 Music, WQXR's new music channel. Brian Wise produces this podcast. The engineer was Bill O'Neill. I'm Naomi Lewin. Thanks for listening.